Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I will be moderating tonight's program brought to you from beautiful Lafayette, California. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Jim Lehrer, noted news anchorman and acclaimed author of numerous novels, including the newly published work, Oh Johnny. Jim Lehrer, best known as the host of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, is a native of Wichita, Kansas, who began his journalistic career as a sports editor of the Jefferson Declaration, the high school paper at Thomas Jefferson High School in San Antonio, Texas. He attended Victoria College and the University of Missouri School of Journalism. After a stint in the Marine Corps, and how appropriate, we're here in the Veterans Hall tonight, he became a reporter for first the Dallas Morning News and then the Dallas Times Herald, where he covered the assassination of JFK in 1963. From 1970 to 73, Mr. Lehrer anchored a news show on KERA-TV, the public broadcasting affiliate in Dallas. In 1973, he began working directly with PBS, designing and then co-anchoring the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, which in 1995, after the death of his co-anchor, Robert McNeil, became the NewsHour as it now is. Mr. Lehrer has moderated 10 presidential candidate debates, with the most recent being the presidential debate between Senators Barack Obama and John McCain on September 26, 2008. He is a journalist, the winner of awards including the University of Missouri School of Journalism's Medal of Honor, a George Foster Peabody Award, the Fred Friendly First Amendment Award, an Emmy Award, a National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Silver Circle, Television Hall of Fame Award, and the National Humanities Medal. His other career is as a writer, and he has published 20 novels, as well as authored 2 screenplays and 2 plays. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, Jim Lehrer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Before we move on, I do need to correct one thing. Robert McNeil retired. He didn't die.
Pardon me. Pardon me.
What's so funny is that I kid him all the time about being the late Robert McNeil. And I can hardly wait to tell him what happened here in Lafayette, California. He's very much alive, lives in New York, and he's doing great.
Please tell him I wish him the best of health.
I will do it.
You've had an amazing run at the NewsHour. Let me start out by asking you, what is it like to have the same job for almost 40 years?
Oh, it's fabulous. I'm blessed. I'm fortunate. You know, the worst thing, at least for me, I assume that many of you all in this room would agree with me, the most annoying thing is to be around somebody who's fortunate and doesn't know it, or at least won't admit it. You are not with such a person here tonight. I am blessed in that I made the decision to be a, quote, journalist and writer, excuse me, when I was 16 years old. And I wanted to do exactly what I'm doing right now. I wanted to do journalism, and I wanted to do it in a big national way. I wanted to be some kind of big deal, and I also wanted to write my fiction. I wanted to write my novels, and so I have done it. And the job at the NewsHour, we're now almost at 35 years, and what's so terrific about it, McNeil also says, and I will give you fair warning here, Gloria, that. He says all the time, you know, if you were ever a guest on our program, Lehrer, we'd never invite you back because your answers are so damn long. But at any rate, the thing here about doing this program for as long as I've been doing it is that When we began 34 years ago, 35 years ago, we had a very specific purpose and some very specific guidelines and some very specific ideas about the kind of journalism we wanted to practice. And we've been allowed, not only allowed, but encouraged by the folks in public broadcasting at all levels for us to be able to do that. And the other part of it is, and then I will consider this question answered, is that journalism is basically little boy, little girl work. It's like if you were sitting here right now and suddenly we heard a siren from something, some vehicle went by here, and my inclination would be to get up from this chair and run and see what happened. And that's what little boys and little girls do, and that's what journalists do no matter what their age is. And I've been doing that, and that's what this is all about. I mean, it can be an automobile accident, or it can be a war, or it can be a financial crisis, it can be anything you name, but it's basically following the sirens. And it has nothing to do with age. Some of the oldest people I know in journalism are 23 years old, and some of the youngest people I know in journalism are 74, 75 years old. And so it's a state of mind, and I am so fortunate to have found the thing I want to do, and to have it still turn me on and still hear those sirens and want to go. I'm very fortunate.
Other than the obvious changes of technology and so on, how has your role in the news hours process of gathering and reporting news changed over the past 35 years?
The process has changed at two or three different levels. First of all, the technology has changed. It used to be to do a television program. I mean, even, let's say this is being televised. In the old days, in order to televise something like this, you'd have to light it up like the top of the sun to get a picture of some kind that you could broadcast, and yet the sound would have to be so precise, and there would be a lot of whining of microphones, and it was just a very tedious, expensive, and labor-intensive business. Well, the technology's made it easier now to go. For instance, if I said, let's say something did happen right here in this room right now, I could broadcast from here. We had a laptop. I'm sure there's somebody here who's got a laptop. With a laptop with internet connection, I could broadcast from here live. We could be on the air in 5-10 minutes. In the old days, that would have taken days to have arranged. All right, so that's one part of it. That's the technology side. The repertorial side, the day-to-day editorial side is pretty much the same. We're in the same business we were in when we began, which is, see, because we come from a basic definition of journalism, which has three parts. There are three parts to journalism as we see it. There's the first part is what happened. Second part is what does it mean? That's the analysis part. And then the third part is what should I think about it? That's the opinionated part. That's the commentators and the pundits. And we believe and practice to this day the idea that no one person should do all three of those. You have a certain group of people that are in the what happened business. They have a certain group that are in the other two, but each very different. And each part of that function should be carefully labeled, as well as done by different people. So that has not changed. The scope of the stories, clearly they have changed. There used to be a concept, but interestingly enough, when I first went into journalism, when I was a newspaper reporter, they had what was called Afghanistanism. That, you know, I mean, who cares about what's going on in Afghanistan? In other words, that was the definition of a story that nobody cared about. And it was basically like the fire department. I mean, if you were a reporter, you would sit in the bullpen, and the story and if something happened, anybody could cover it. Can I tell a quick story?
Of course.
Okay.
The more the better.
I was a reporter for the Dallas Times Herald. I was the courthouse reporter, the criminal side of the courthouse reporter. In other words, I covered criminal trials. And I showed up for, it was a more afternoon newspaper. I came to work at 5:30 in the morning, 6 in the morning. And the city editor making assignments, I sat down at his desk, and he said, "Jim, I got some good news and some bad news. The good news is that you're not going to the courthouse today. The bad news is you're covering a symposium at SMU, this was in Dallas, at Southern Methodist University, where all of the great scientists who've been working on the moon explorations and all of that are coming to share their findings. And it's a hell of a story. It's here in Dallas, and we've saved a huge hole for page one for you to cover and update, because we had 5 or 6 editions, meaning 5 or 6 deadlines all day." And he said, and you updated all day. And I said, "Ho, ho, ho." He said, "Here, go." So I go to SMU. Thing starts at 8 o'clock, and I get there. There's about this many people. Now, maybe 2/3 this number of people. All of them hanging on every word and every slide and every whatever. And I do. I go to the back of the room, sit down, and I realize about 10, 15. My first deadline was 9:30. I first had to call in an update at 9:30. And I started listening to what these people were saying. I realized I didn't understand one word. So I looked down, it was fortunately a kind of a theater setting, you know, where the seats were, and I could see down, there were several people not too far down who were nodding, they were getting it. So I went, and there was an empty seat next to one of these guys, so I went down, I sat next to him, and I said, I'm Jimmy Charles Lehrer, the Dallas Times Herald, and I told him the truth. I said, "I'm here to cover this thing, and my job's on the line because they've got this huge hole on the front page of my newspaper, and I don't know what in the hell is going on." And I said, "Do you know?" And he said, "Do I know? I'm Sammy Sue, professor, wah, 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 wah." And I said, "Would you act as a translator?" And he said, "I'd love to." So here's what happened. I'm sitting on this guy's left. He's sitting on the right. And somebody up on the stage would say something. He'd say, "That means..." It was like at the UN, you know, where you And what's so wonderful about it, why I can tell the story with a smile, is I got away with it. I went at 9:25. I went outside in the hallway, and of course, this was long before there were cell phones and all that stuff. And I got on the city desk, and I said, "Here's my story." And I'm dictating it off the top of my head, which is what afternoon newspaper people had to do. And the rewrite man, of course, the guy I know, he says, he writes it all down. He had made some changes here and this and all sort of thing. And he says, "Do you know what in the hell you're talking about? Is this for you?" I said, "Yes, go, send it, go." And I spent all day with that man and updated. Our last deadline was 3:30 in the afternoon. First was 9:30, and then we had him all day, and the last was 3:30. Now, the kicker on this story is, I got away with it. Not only did I get away with it, I won an Associated Press Award for best breaking science news in a Texas newspaper that year. The only problem is I can't remember why I told that story. Well, it had to do with how journalism... That's right.
How it's changing. Yes.
Yeah, today, yes. You'd have the person covering that story. The reason, I forgot to tell you, the reason that I was covering it is because the science reporter was sick. I mean, they did have a science reporter on the newspaper, but anyhow. So things have changed that way.
Well, I'm going to throw in a question from the audience, which just shows that out of the mouth of babes, this was going to be my next question, but here it is in large handwriting signed Tanner L. from a young person, I believe. "Dear Mr. Lehrer, what do you think was the most memorable story you have reported on?" That was going to be my next question.
Oh, well, I'll give you a serious answer to that. Was the assassination of President Kennedy. And I'll tell you the story about that and why it shaped not only me, but anybody who was a hands-on journalist on that day and at that time, particularly right then in Dallas. I was, again, working for that same newspaper. And afternoon newspaper, the president was only going to be in Dallas for about 3 hours. He was going to make a noon speech. My assignment, I was the federal reporter by then. I had moved up from the criminal side of the courthouse. And my assignment, because he was only going to be there, and we had all these deadlines and all of that, our entire reportorial staff was on the story at various places. And my assignment was to cover the arrival of President Kennedy and Mrs. Kennedy and the party at Love Field and then stay there until he came back and then report the departure, and then the other reporters would do everything in between. It had been raining that morning in Dallas. I had, with the Secret Service and the Dallas Police Department, had arranged, because they understood the situation, we'd explained it, and the Times Herald negotiated a deal so I could have an open telephone line right on the fence line, because the Air Force One was going to come over from Fort Worth, just a short flight. And then the motorcade was going to leave from there, but ordinary citizens were allowed to come and wave and welcome and all that sort of stuff behind a fence, and I had an open phone line just inside the fence to report, and they had said, well, they're about to leave Fort Worth, and I was testing the phone to the rewrite desk, rewrite man, and he said to me, hey, look, I'm going to be writing under pressure here, under deadline in a moment. I'd just like to know, is the bubble top going to be on the presidential limousine? And I looked down the ramp. There was a ramp there at Love Field. I couldn't see. I knew there were 10 vehicles in the motorcade, but I couldn't see them because they were lined up, but they were down a ramp. And so I said, well, I'll go find out. And I was a federal reporter. I knew the Secret Service agents that were assigned in Dallas, particularly the guy who was the head of the Dallas Office of Secret Service. So he was standing there. I went over to him. I could see the motorcade. I got to where the motorcade was. I could see it down the ramp. And there was a bubble top over the presidential limousine. I said to the agent in charge, I said, telling the truth. Rewrite wants to know, boom, boom, boom. And he said, well, because it had been raining, but it had cleared. But anyhow, the agent says, well, it looks clear. And then he yelled at another agent who had a two-way radio, one of these big two-way radios. He said, check downtown, is it clear? So he checks downtown. He says, clear downtown. The agent says to the other agents who are in the motorcade, take the bubble top off. I go back. Do my job to the rewrite man, and then do to finish the story. I walked back into the Love Field terminal, and immediately the word came. And I don't know how I got into the city desk on the phone. That was before. So anyhow, I got in there, and they said go to Parkland Hospital. I got there just as they announced that President Kennedy was dead. Then I was told go to the police station because they just arrested somebody. Well, that was Lee Harvey Oswald. And I spent the rest of the day at the police station. And about midnight, the place was chaos. I mean, there were reporters and there were cops and agents and everybody. The place was just a mob scene, the Dallas police station. About midnight, there had been a meeting going on between the police chief and a bunch of big shots. And I just went down to the ante, waited in the ante room with several other reporters what they would say when they came out. And the door opens, meeting breaks up, the door opens, and that agent who had taken the bubble top off sees me, and he comes right over to me. And he was an old man. He was probably 42 years old. He comes over to me, and big tears in his eyes. I'm just a kid. I'm a real kid. Big tears in his eyes. And he says, Jim, if I just hadn't taken the bubble top off. Now, he didn't do anything wrong, but it's the what-ifs and the what-ifs and what-ifs, and there's still all kinds of arguments about it. Because the bubble top was not bulletproof. It was just thin plexiglass, quarter of an inch. And the issue has always been, well, yeah, it wasn't bulletproof, but Oswald didn't know it wasn't. A lot of people, in fact, some people in the Secret Service thought it was bulletproof. They weren't that close to it. So that maybe Oswald If the bubble top had been up there, maybe they wouldn't even have taken the shot. They said, "What the hell with it?" You know, might have just not fired the shot. Or if he had fired the shot, it might have been deflected. Even though it wasn't bulletproof, it might have deflected the shots. And then there's another theory that a lot of the Secret Service guys believe, former Secret Service guys believe, that the glass, it was so more like glass than it was plastic, that it would have splintered into to sharp shards. And probably would have not only killed Jack Kennedy, would probably have killed Mrs. Kennedy and the two Secret Service agents in the car and all that sort of stuff. So, again, a very long answer, but that story, the Kennedy story, the assassination story, I learned in a way, and I was 1963, so I was... I had gotten out of the Marine Corps in 1959, had gone right into newspaper work, so that was 4 years into my journalism thing, and I was shaken forever about the enormity of an event and how the enormity of one event can change so many things. You just look back through the chain reaction of history that came as a result of that. And influences the things that affected the people. I don't mean personally, but from a policy standpoint and a political standpoint, so it's an easy answer, long answer, but an easy answer as to why it's so important to me.
And I'm sure so many other stories have those multiple dimensions,
exactly.
Only some of which you're actually able to report. One person in the audience feels that in the old days, the segments on the NewsHour were longer and fewer, and now they are more numerous and shorter in length. First of all, is that accurate? And if so, why?
You know, I think that is accurate. We in the early days, we particularly the very early days, when the program began, it had the worst title in the history of television. You're not going to believe this. But the name of this television program was The Robert McNeil Report. Fortunately, after about six months, they came to their senses and talked to my mother, and they changed the title to to The McNeil-Lehrer Report. But in those days, we did one story a night. So, and our whole concept was we were not an alternative, we were a supplement. Watch your favorite daily news, nightly news program, and then come to us for in-depth of one story, in-depth coverage of one story. Then we went to an hour. That was in 19. We started that program in 75, and then we went to an hour in the news hour in 1983, and we changed the whole purpose of the enterprise to we were no longer a supplement, we were an alternative. We took the position, you don't have to watch anybody else, just watch us. We would tell you, give you the headlines and all that sort of stuff. And in doing so, we started adjusting the format. And we're doing some more of it. We always tinkered. If you ever stop tinkering with an operation like ours, you'll eventually go, and deservedly so. Because the world is, it's not just the world of events, but the world in which you receive information about events is changing. I mean, my God, look what's happened just in the last few years. When I explained the technology, well, look at the internet technology and the information explosion and everything that's possible now that was not. I mean, we could sit here and 10 seconds get answers. I don't know if we had a trio, I didn't bring my trio with me, but if I had it, I mean, I didn't bring it tonight, I could in 10 seconds find out information that used to take days to find out when I was a reporter in the beginning. And but anyhow, on the length of the segments, we're just trying to have a rhythm to it. You know, every piece doesn't have to be the same length, and it doesn't have to be presented. When you do serious journalism, and this is not a cop out, please. I hope you don't hear what I'm saying and say, "Oh my God, you're just trying to make excuses." I believe if you're doing serious journalism, and there's no question that's what we're doing. So, you know, in other words, we're not yucking it up on the air. So we're not in the entertainment business, okay? And we know that, and we're not trying to entertain people. But if you're going to do serious things, then you should at least we should do everything we can to make that interesting, that people will hang in there. Maybe they don't know about Nunn, Luger, and whatever. Maybe we can tell the story in such a way, slightly differently, that would make it more interesting than just say, okay, you know, the old the aspirin concept of, you know, here's, you know, take an aspirin, get a good night's sleep, and you enjoy this. So anyhow, we're always fooling with it. But the impression is correct. We used to do a lot more segments that had three and four guests, and we do a lot more now that have maybe two, and we do shorter segments. Sometimes we're experimenting once again, because we're trying to understand the new world order. Is that a lot of people, you know, appointment television, where you go at 6 o'clock or at 7 o'clock or 6:30 to watch a particular program. There are a lot of people not doing that anymore. They still want the news hour, but they want it when they want to watch it. And they want to watch what parts of it, and they want to watch it online, or they want to, you know. So we are all of the above. We're working on all of those things, but not changing the journalism, but changing the way it's available, changing the accessibility of it, and trying to make it more accessible is what we're doing. And and sometimes some of it works, some of it doesn't. You know, we've had some, you know, believe it or not, we've made some mistakes. Yeah.
You've raised really the overall question of the major changes we're seeing in the media, and some might say the demise of some traditional media like newspapers. And I have a few questions about that. We're experiencing this, of course, in the Bay Area as the San Francisco Chronicle wobbles. I've heard that public media in general is experiencing an increase in viewership and listenership. Is that true of PBS? Is it true of your show?
It is absolutely true.
Do you have any data statistics on that?
Yes. Robert McNeil used to say, you know, I'll give you a side here. McNeil says, I do this all the time. I say, McNeil says, when I say something I want to say and I don't want to say it myself, I always put it on
your
McNeil.
Alter ego.
But McNeil used to say that ratings don't matter to us in public television unless they're very high. What's happened here in the last 2 or 3 years, as the revolution has spread in informational technology and the way people get their news, yes, the size of our audiences is steadied or risen, and as our internet and online presence grows more, that's going to continue to grow as well. And I think I don't want to make too big a deal of it yet, because it's still in transition. I don't know what the end result's going to be. The panic over newspapers, like the San Francisco Chronicle, that's legitimate. That's something really, and for all kinds of different reasons. It goes back to what I said earlier. Journalism is journalism, journalism is journalism. It's where you, how you get it, that may change as long as you get it. What I'm worried about is the demise of the newspapers. You know, in the beginning, there has to be a news story before the shouters and the bloggers and the whiners and the legitimate opinionators start talking. Mm-hmm. And the entertainers, you know, the Jon Stewarts and the Stephen Colberts go at the news to entertain people with about the news. In the beginning, there has to be a story. First of all, you got to know what the hell he said. What did he say? What did the president really say? What was in that bill? I mean, that passed yesterday. And if your first information about that news development comes from in a joke or in a shout, I think we've got a problem. And every time a newspaper and the people who have traditionally done those first stories, who go to the city hall and go to the state house and go to the county courthouse and go to the White House and go to the this and the go to the that, are usually print reporters. And then it's picked up and people move on it and talk about it and all of that. And there is a shared, there used to be what I called a shared set of facts before the disagreeing and the shouting began, that at least we could agree that the mayor signed the law to make the city of Lafayette, everybody had to write left-handed or move somewhere else, you know. At least we could agree on that and then have the disagreement. And what I think we're, the putting that with what's happening in public broadcasting, and particularly the success of the NewsHour and other ventures like it, is it may be that we have to start thinking, and a lot of people are beginning to start thinking that public media maybe have to do what happened first step. And because now you've got, I mean, and I'm not disparaging anybody. I'm not even complaining about the fact that we've got now right-wing cable networks and left-wing cable networks. I mean, that's fine. That's great. And we got all kinds of blogs, and we got all kinds of people on radio yelling at each other. That's great. More the merrier. That's what our democratic society is all about. And but as I say, the first step is the one that we've got to be careful of, because I'll give you an example. I know I keep saying one of these days I'm going to answer one of these questions, yes or no, I promise.
That would be an interviewer's nightmare.
You're right. It's just to illustrate my point, the best illustration that I can think of at this moment. It was about a year ago or less, an anonymous person in the government of the United States called the city desk, or the Metropolitan Desk, they call them now, at the Washington Post, and said, the veterans, this is a place to tell this story, the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are not being well treated at Walter Reed Army Hospital, and particularly on stress syndrome and those kinds of things, but on all levels. The places where they're living, the whole system, they're overloaded. They hadn't expected the war to be what it turned out to be. They didn't expect that many casualties, so they weren't ready for it. And some wounded veterans and their families are suffering. The person on the desk at the Washington Post wrote it down. It was anonymously given. In other words, there was nobody to check any, to call and whatever. It was not somebody handing anybody a story like a press release. And the person on the desk passed on the memo to one of the editors, a sub-editor, not the editor, but one of the editors, a national news editor. And he looked at the thing and said, I think we need to look into this, okay? And they gave it to a reporter just to do some quick checking, just to see, is this crazy stuff or is this real? Is there a smell there, a smell of a story, as they call it in our business? And he got a smell of a story. And so they then assigned two of their best reporters to work full-time on that story, and they worked on it for 4 months before one line went in that newspaper. Now, and they were given full resources to travel anywhere they wanted to go and whatever. Cost in newspaper terms a lot of money to do that story. Now, they won every kind of award in the world, but we, the big we, would never have known about Walter Reed if that process of journalism had not been allowed to run its course and allowed by the resources, as much as, you can sit around the newsroom all day at the NewsHour, anybody else's. Yeah, that's a hell of a story. We ought to cover that. Unfortunately, we don't have anybody available to do it, or we don't have the power, we don't have the resources to do it. They did at the Washington Post. Now, increasingly, this is true, is probably more true in the local and the regional level than it is at the national, international level, although it's beginning there as well. There are fewer and fewer resources to follow. That's the smell of the story. And that is not an in-house problem, just an in-house problem for those like me who practice little boy, little girl work of journalism. This is for all of you and for all of us as citizens. And so that's why people are now thinking of other things we need to do. If the Washington Post of this world aren't going to do that kind of stuff, who is? And how do you construct a mechanism that is trusted, that has credibility? So you would the Washington Post is the Washington Post. So you either like the Washington, but you either trust the Washington Post or you don't. But at least it's an institution that you can bounce off of. The Associated Press, there are all kinds of news. The New York Times, San Francisco, you know, anything. The NewsHour, it's what it's all about. It's trusting the people that made the journalism decisions that got you where you are with the story. So we got it. We'd have a lot. There are a lot of problems here. And the good news is, and this is the only good news I have, is that we know how bad it is within the business. Because I mean, just in the last 10 days, 2 and 3 major newspapers have gone bankrupt. And there's one newspaper somebody told me about yesterday. Maybe I'm not sure it's the Sacramento Bee. They had a new staff of 200. Now they have 20.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell can you do there? You can cover 2 or 3 luncheons and a couple of automobile crashes, and you got it. I mean, that's not going to work. It's not going to work for us. It's not going to work for the Democratic Society. Thomas Jefferson, you remember him? He said to his fellow founders and sister founders. He probably said more to the fellow founders now that I think about it. Because women weren't allowed to found countries at that point. But he said they were
behind the scenes.
Yeah, he said, look, if we're going to have a democratic society, we're going to create this democratic society, this new thing. It's only going to work if we have an informed electorate. And the only mechanism that has been created to facilitate an informed electorate are the boring reporters, or the little boys and little girls who go to the courthouse and say, whatever. I mean, that's where it is. That's where it starts. So this is not an idle exercise, at least in my opinion. And I think my guess is that every one of you all would agree with me. And if you don't, I'm sure you won't speak up. So
we'll get back to this question of the media before we end tonight. I do want to tell our listeners and viewers not in the room with us that this is the Commonwealth Club radio and internet television program. And tonight we're speaking with news anchorman Jim Lehrer. You brought up the effects of the war is in Afghanistan and Iraq on the returning veterans. And that is just a perfect segue to the topic of your newest novel, your 20th novel.
Now, that's a great segue.
Oh, Johnny. And could you tell us a little bit
Sure.
about the plot of the novel?
You bet. With great, great pleasure, I will do that. Oh, Johnny is a kid named Johnny Wrigley. He is 18 years old. He lives in a little town in western Maryland.
Called?
Lafayette.
This is true.
There are angles fiction and connections to everything. Anyhow, he has two things that he's obsessed by. He wants to be a Major League Baseball player. He wants to play center field. There are some folks here, I can guess, a few who will recognize the name of Pete Reeser, who played center field for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1940s. And he was a guy, he was an all-around baseball player. I mean, he hit home runs, he stole bases, he could catch anything they threw at him, as they say, including a cold. That was a great baseball line. Anyhow, he also had this bad habit. He was a hustler. He had a bad habit of running into the fence all the time. I mean, 11 times he was knocked out. Once they gave him last rites, lying on the field, center field in Brooklyn. Anyhow, Johnny, wants to be Pete Reeser, and he has the dream. He not only has the dream, he has the skills. He's a great ball player, this kid, Johnny Wrigley. But World War II comes, and he joins the Marines. And he's gone through boot camp at Paris Island, and he's put on a troop train to go to the West Coast to serve in the Pacific. It's a troop train of Marines. They stop in Wichita, Kansas, which is about halfway It is. It's halfway. It's in the middle of the country. And they let the Marines, they stopped the train, let the Marines off to kind of stretch their legs and all that. And it was all planned. You know, they have women who come and give them cigarettes and apples and all that sort of stuff. Johnny Wrigley sees one of these young women, one of these Kansas young women, and she is the most beautiful thing this kid has ever seen in his life. And lo and behold, this young woman sees Johnny Wrigley. And this is a big crowd. They're going to all these Marines and all this sort of stuff. But they see each other. And something happens. Something magic happens. And they have what is what I will refer to as an experience. And the train is only there for 20, 25 minutes. And
you can imagine.
If you read the book, you won't have to imagine anymore. But at any rate, finally they blow. They've got to get back on the train because they got the troop train's got to move on. And then, of course, they blow the whistle, and Johnny runs and gets back just in the nick of time, back on the train as the train moves west. And he realizes that they exchanged first names, but that was it. She knew his name was Johnny. He knew her name was Betsy, and that was it. So he goes on to war. And are there any other former Marines here? Okay. Well, former Marines know that the life expectancy of a flamethrower operator in combat during those days was zip, because, for obvious reasons, flamethrower shoots off, you know, its flames, and then everybody shoots at where that flame started. So the first thing they're trained, flamethrower operators trained to do is shoot your flame and then run like hell, and in the opposite, you know, to the side. Anyhow, Johnny, he, you know, it's a typical Marine story. They line him up, you know, he's assigned to the 1st Marine Division, and they say, anybody in here an athlete? So Johnny, yes, sir. Baseball player. Great, you're a flamethrower operator. And he becomes a flamethrower operator. And he goes ashore at Peleliu. It's not a story that many Marines even like to tell, or many Marines even know about, modern-day Marines at least. And everybody's around then knows. The Battle of Peleliu is an island in the Pacific where they decided to take the island to help MacArthur in his return to the Philippines. It was on the route. And there was a very, very unqualified, jerky Navy officer who did a reconnaissance of the island by flying over the island and said, well, there's no problem here, no resistance here. It'll take 3 days to take the island. They, something like 15,000 Marines went ashore. Took months, and 6,000 Marines died in that battle. And then once they took the island, the powers that be said, you know, on second thought, we didn't need Peleliu after all. And then they told these kids, the kids who survived, you know, it would be terrible for the war effort to go home and talk about it, so just don't talk about it. So the story never really got out. And when I was in the Marine Corps in the 1950s, some places where I was with the 3rd Marine Division in the Far East, you'd go to an officers club, Marine officers club, and somebody walked in who had been at Peleliu. Everybody had to stand. They'd say, "He was at Peleliu." You stand, everybody drinks, but it's very private kind of. It's a Marine thing. Anyhow, Johnny was at Peleliu. See, I'm getting all carried away here. But anyway, Johnny was at Peleliu, and he was at Okinawa. And he survived. And one particular case, he survived because he was thinking about Betsy, and he did something as a result of that caused him to not be blown up, as the guy with him did. Well, it was, and died. So Johnny, the war is over. He survives unscathed. He's ready to go back and be a baseball player, and he's going to find Betsy, and he's going to live the dream life. I mean, my God. And he comes back to Wichita, gets off the train, and he can't find her. And but he keeps looking. He keeps looking. He keeps trying to live his dreams. And that's all I'm going to tell you.
A true novelist. It does occur to me, and I'll just make this observation in light of the story that you did about the returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, having read O Johnny, that he does suffer from something we call today post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Absolutely, he does. He never gets over it. He saw too much and did too much, and he mistakenly. I mean, it's war. It's combat. I mean, very close in combat, and he mistakenly kills some civilians. And he can't get over that. He can't ever get that out of his head. And he sees others, so many of his buddies die. And he suffered from, if it was not then called, mm-hmm. post-stress syndrome, but that's what it was. And it affected him throughout his life.
We won't betray any more of the book. But one person in the audience wants to know, since we watch you almost every night on PBS, when and where do you write? Have you found the time to write 20 novels?
Well, here again, I'll try to give you a reasonably short answer. But I am again blessed. I was blessed by a serious health problem. To tell you the truth, I had a heart attack 25 or so years ago, and in the process of recovering, I had a great doctor, and the doctor said, you know, it was a pretty serious thing, and they weren't. He didn't say it this way, but essentially said, you know, how much, you know, you ought to start thinking about how you're going to spend the rest of your time. Could be 5 days, 5 years, could be 55, you know, could be 500. Who knows? But why don't you give some thought to it? Because there were a lot of risk factors that, you know, I was a heavy smoker. I hadn't exercised since I got out of the Marine Corps because I decided to hell with that. You know, I'd run up and down enough hills in the rain and all of that. So there were a lot of things that I didn't do and that caused a heart attack. But he said, you know, try to go through all the things in your life that eat energy, cause stress and anxiety and all of that. Make a list of them all. So I did. I had job, family, all that stuff on there. And then he said, well, go back and eliminate half of them. So I had to keep the family, decided I had to work for a living, but I cut out an awful lot of things. What I had put on the list of, then he said, you know, and adjust it with the things you want to do. In other words, start, if there's a list over here of things you have to do and don't want to do anymore, now here's a list of the things you do want to do. Well, I put writing right at the top after my family and my job. Because I had gotten away from it because of the daily journalism pressures. And our kids were small when our kids were small. And my fiction writing had just gone by the boards. And at the time of the heart attack, our two oldest daughters were then in college, and our youngest daughter was in high school. So I didn't have the excuse anymore, the kids and all of that. And so I started back writing. And in the process, for instance, of adjusting my life, I vowed, for instance, that I would take a nap every day, and I still do to this day. And because, explain why. Because I'm the editor of the program, in addition to the pretty face, I'm working all day, you know, all day. You know, on the doing the journalism stuff and all that, and then I have to go on the air at the end of that day and be my best, you know, and try to avoid making a fool of myself on national television, and so the nap, what the nap does, and it's 45 minutes or an hour every day. I lie down on the couch in my office. What it does essentially is divide the day into 2 days and gives me, I still have energy at 6 o'clock Eastern time. It's when we do our program, but the bottom line is, it's all said and done. Once I stopped doing the things I didn't want to do or didn't have to do anymore, and just do the things I wanted to do, I found out that I had plenty of time to do everything. as a practical matter, the fiction writing is so important to me that I do, and so I just integrated. It's a part of my life now. I wake up in the morning. I can wake up in a hotel in San Francisco, or I can be on an airplane, or I can wake up at home, or wherever, whatever. I don't ever say, well, what am I going to write today? It's just, what am I going to do on my writing today? Maybe write another great, fabulous sentence or paragraph, or it may be some editing or whatever. But I do something on my novels every day. We work morning newspaper hours, meaning our first meetings are 10:15. I come into the office about 8 o'clock. There's nobody there. So there's plenty of time for me to write, and I do that literally every day. I'm also helped by the fact my wife, Kate, is also a novelist. So we speak the same emotional language. One of us doesn't talk for 3 days because we're stuck in some, some novel writing funk. It doesn't break up the marriage, So I have a lot of things going for me, and I also have the daily journalism experience. Daily journalism teaches you, and the way it goes, I mean, you have to go from a dead run to a dead run to a dead run. You can't say, oh, I don't think I'm quite ready to report that story yet, Well, you just go, move. And the same thing happens when I move from a journalism project, G20 to bus driver in the 1950s, I go just from one to the other, one and back and forth. And when I'm working on a novel, and I always am, it's a little bit like having a low-grade fever. It's with me all the time. So, I enjoy both of them. See, the journalism isn't depriving me of my lifelong desire to write fiction, because I'm doing that. And the life and the writing fiction is not keeping me from functioning, I don't think, as a professional journalist. And so, in other words, they complement each other, and they fit my life, and they fit it perfectly, and I'm just very fortunate.
Here's an interesting question. You were one of the longest-term, high-profile observers of world events. What do you think about the adage, the more things change, the more they stay the same?
I agree with that.
Okay, then.
Gotcha, didn't I? You didn't think I could do that.
Okay.
Okay.
That's it. Let's switch to one of your many other roles, which is as moderator of presidential debates.
Yep.
What are your guiding principles when moderating a presidential debate?
First, second, third, fourth, the first 15 principles are, it ain't about you, Mr. Ms. Moderator. I tell people all the time, I already got the best job in journalism. When I'm doing a presidential debate, I'm not auditioning for some other job. And the other rule is, if the debate is over and they're talking about anything I did or said, any question I asked, any question I didn't ask, anything I said or did, then I failed. Because the debate is about the candidates and what matters. These debates are the only time during a presidential campaign where you get to see the candidates side by side on the same stage. It doesn't matter. They could be talking baseball. It doesn't matter what they're talking about. Because usually by the time you had the debates, issues have all kind of sorted themselves out one way or another. What you're listening to is body language as much as you're listening to word language. That's not a good word, is it? That I don't think that word is regular language, let me say. And so it's I'm very much aware of that. I'm also the crucial thing that I carry with me when through every one of those things is it isn't just another television show. In the unlikely event that I screw up the news hour some night, I can look out at the red light and say, I'll do better tomorrow. Screw up a presidential debate, you can affect who's going to be the next president of the United States. The preparation and all the security, there are all kinds of security of information. For instance, just think about it for a moment. There's no candidate for president of the United States who isn't always aware during these debates, going in during them and coming out, that the whole election could turn on one line. one word, poorly phrased, or, and it's happened. So any advantage that any candidate could have would be worth a lot of all kinds of gold to that candidate, but and to the people who work for that candidate. So there's a great pressure to try to find out, well, what is Billy Bob going to ask? And what do you think, you know, and the pundits do, all that sort of stuff. So I maintain huge security about what I'm working on and what I'm doing and all that. Because I choose, the debates that I do, I choose all the questions, write all the questions, choose them all. And then about 5 days before every debate, I just stop. You don't even talk to our NewsHour staff or to anybody else. But the preparation is also apples, and it's trying to sort through apples, and that's what my wife is very good at. You know, if you've got candidate A here, candidate B there, and I'm going to ask matching questions, they got to both be apples. I can't ask you an apple question and ask you an orange question. And you know what that meaning, that it's got to be perceived to be apples, apples. The perception for in a presidential debate, and sometimes is almost, from my point of view, is almost as important as the reality. If I am perceived as having been unfair, either, you know, too heavy or on one side or the other, or too light on one side or the other, then that to me is that's a devastating thing. That is the worst thing that can be said about me and what I have done. So that means the questions have to be perceived as fair. Well, you just ask. I mean, you just threw a lob to Billy Bob. Well, you really, yeah, and you really, you know, a tough one for Sammy Sue. And anyhow, it's it's a searing experience to answer to shut up. I've got scars all through me for all these debates, but they're also an exhilarating thing, and I consider them a public service. To tell you the truth of the matter, I don't. I feel that when people like me are asked to do that, they have to do it. Somebody else have the skills to do this, you have to do it. I mean, it's like any other public service.
I think we owe you a debt of gratitude for being such a steady hand over so many years with so many presidential debates.
Thank you. It's really been a service to the country. Thank you.
What person did you find to be the most difficult subject to interview?
Did you hear that question? I'm sure the folks in the back didn't hear it. The question was, why did I choose Lafayette as the name for the town? Oh, Gloria, I don't think I've ever interviewed a difficult person.
But you've done it so well that no one would have known that it was difficult.
Nobody would have known it. I'm so busy, you know, doing my thing. I don't pay attention to whether people.
Go.
No, there's some real, you know, there. I don't want to be the bearer of this news. If you haven't heard this before, but there are some really dopey people out there. And there are also some people that are not very nice sometimes, and particularly to one another. And McNeil, when we started, he said, you know, we're going to do civilized discourse. Capital C, civilized. Well, not everybody is civilized, we've discovered. So we have to tell people, hey, you know, don't talk over other people. You know, you trust us. You come on our program, you trust us, you will be heard. And so don't shout, don't yell at people, and if they do that, we don't ask them back. What was the question?
Well, the tough one is, why did you think, and I'm just asking an audience question here,
yes,
why
ma'am.
Did you think it was newsworthy to have an exit interview with Dick Cheney?
Well, the thing about Lafayette... he was a vice president of the United States. Some would suggest one of the most powerful vice presidents in history. He influenced a lot of decisions very openly, and some maybe not so openly, but he did, having to do with war and peace and a lot of other things, energy policy, a lot of things. And I had interviewed him several times, going back to when he was a congressman from Wyoming and when he was Secretary of Defense. You know what he used to do? When he was Secretary of Defense, remember, in the first Gulf War. And there were other things that happened during that time. He respected the NewsHour so much that he would come as Secretary of Defense and sit down and let me interview him for as long as it took. Now, you tend to remember things like that. And when he became vice president, I interviewed him right when he first became vice president, interviewed him several times throughout. It just seemed a part of the it was a continuity interview more than a farewell thing. And because I don't know him that well. It wasn't you know, a bunch of high school buddies getting together saying goodbye. It wasn't that kind of deal.
He's an interesting guy, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
Has any thought been given to a West Coast update segment on days when breaking news would make it relevant? For now, we get 3 p.m. news.
Well, on the that's a great question. We have on the NewsHour, we do update for the West Coast feed, which is 9 o'clock Eastern time. But the only it has to be a major news development, no question about it. And we have tried to figure out ways to do it more often and do it better, and it's very expensive. You got to keep the thing going. NPR was going to help us out. We were going to do a partnership with NPR, and they would do some updating from the West Coast, but it didn't work, and that's the result of of all things. Some things don't work. This one didn't work. But we update the program itself in the news summary or on the recap or redo it. But you're right. 95% of the time, the program that you see on the West Coast is the one that we did at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, which is 3 o'clock your time. But yes.
There are literally a dozen questions here about the demise of newspapers and the news media from the audience. I think this is something we're all quite worried about, as mm-hmm. you are, given the importance of an informed citizenry. If you could, aside from advising everyone to watch the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, if you could do one thing to improve the prospects of the media today, let's say you were a philanthropy with a lot of money, which in fact is something many foundations
are
considering
Absolutely.
Today.
They are.
What would you do? What would you do to have an impact on the quality of news reporting? And
I would make an appeal to every philanthropy of all levels, and lay it on the line, and use a lot of some of the things that I said earlier about it. This is important. And then I would try to figure out a way to create a serious nonprofit major news gathering organization for everybody. In other words, you would do the Walter Reed story, but you wouldn't do it just for the Washington Post. You would do it, the Washington Post could run it. Anybody could run it, free. You would also have an element that would, part of it would be visual. All kinds of visual, still photographs, as well as television coverage. You could do it of all different lengths. You could do it for audio. You'd make it available. Anybody with a pink iPod and their name engraved on it, they could get it on. They could do it if they wanted. They could get it. It would be available to everybody. And then the Sacramento Bee or the San Francisco Chronicle or the McKinney, Texas Courier Gazette wants has serious journalism, they have a place that they, and it doesn't cost them a dime. It'd have to be constructed in a way that had the trust of everybody, but it'd have to be serious. You'd have to be willing to break some china every once in a while, or otherwise forget it. You'd have to be willing to be completely transparent. It'd have to be the most transparent news organizations. When I started, they didn't even do corrections. You could get anything wrong in a newspaper. They never corrected it. And I remember the guy at the Dallas Morning. I almost got fired my first job because I got the name of the deceased in an obit. The name of the deceased mixed up with the name of the funeral home. And you can't get everything right. but they didn't do corrections because they didn't want to suggest to the public that everything in here wasn't 100% correct. And if you admitted one mistake, oh my God, how many more mistakes are they making? So, but we would have to redo that. we would have to say, okay, Sausage Factory no longer off limits. And I think that's one of many, many, many. If you ask me what I would do, that's what I would do. And it's actually been suggested to me to try to do it. And I might. I've just got a lot of other things. I got to, you know, first of all, I've got to finish this event. And
which we're just about to do.
I got 12 more novels to write. No, it's a possibility. I don't know if it's feasible, and it would take. It's not going to be done overnight. If it is,
you'd be a wonderful champion for such a project. It is the time for the last question on our program today, and while acknowledging that you, like your retired former partner, are still very much alive. Have you picked your successor yet?
You know something, there's an old cliche. You know what a definition of a cliche is? The truth. The cliche about events like this, where people ask questions, is when they say the last question, it's usually, that's when the guy says, Mr. Lehrer, I happen to have in my hand a copy of a sworn statement that, that proves that you've been stealing money from PBS. You think, oh, my God, why did I answer the last question?
So there's no easy question like that one. Have you thought about a successor?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. Certainly. Yes.
Well, good. Thank you.
Shut up, right?
On that note, our thanks to Jim Lehrer, anchor of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, acclaimed writer and author of the new novel, Oh, Johnny.
Thank you all. Thank you.
We also thank our audiences here in Lafayette, on the radio, on television, and the internet. Do visit the blog site if you want to continue this discussion. I'm Gloria Duffy. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 106 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.